Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome once again to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and this is the podcast where I ask my guests to tell me the five things from their life that they would choose to preserve in a time capsule. Well, four that they would preserve, because they cherish them, and one that they regret and would like to see buried in the ground so that they never have to think about it again. My guest in this episode is David Mitchell. David is one of our most successful authors, with such books as Cloud Atlas, Last Man Standing, and... what? Oh, the other David Mitchell. Really? Oh, all right. David Mitchell, the actor, who is one of the nicest men in the world, despite all his protestations, is, I'm delighted to say, my guest in this episode. As a student, David was president of the Cambridge Footlights, where he met his longtime comedy partner and friend, Robert Webb, and a recurring performer in many of his shows, Olivia Colman. David and Robert went on to write for Armstrong and Miller and the comedy series Big Train, before being given their own show, first on BBC Radio with That Mitchell and Webb Sound, and then on TV with the BAFTA-winning That Mitchell and Webb Look. At the same time, they began performing in the Channel 4 smash hit, Peep Show. As well as becoming a regular columnist for The Observer and The Guardian, David co-hosted 10 O'Clock Live with Jimmy Carr, Charlie Brooker and Lauren Laverne. He is the presenter of the Radio 4 series The Unbelievable Truth and is a regular team captain on Would I Lie to You with Lee Mack and Rob Brydon. In 2016, he was cast as William Shakespeare in Ben Elton's BBC sitcom Upstart Crow, which became a hit West End play and which he was performing in at the Guildford Theatre in London when lockdown closed all theatres. And that's what David and I are discussing when you join our conversation. Well, specifically, we're talking about My Tomatoes. And I'm sure that if anything is going to keep you listening, it's My Tomatoes. Sadly, we also talk about other things. Still, I hope you enjoy it. And the only thing that I have achieved in that whole time is I grew an enormous number of tomatoes.
That's not nothing, is it?
That's not a bad year.
Yeah.
I had such an enormous collection of tomato plants. So I planted them all over my garden, everywhere. If it had been hemp...
yeah.
I would have been arrested.
Do you think how farms start? That people get, I've got this wheat. I just wanted three or four. No one wanted them. And so now it used to be a garden. It's a wheat field. I mean, got rid of everything at the rhododendrons. I now can't think of any other sorts of flowers. The roses, all gone, just
it's
wheat.
Absolute monoculture.
I mean, I love it, but other people think it's samey. So did you got a lot of tomatoes from the plants? They weren't all eaten by foxes and rats.
No,
and
no, we didn't have a chicken eaten by a fox.
Right, but they didn't make a tomato-y sauce.
No, something to go with it. It wasn't an Italian fox. But all in all, it's been ridiculous, isn't it? I can't believe the amount of time that's gone by.
No, yeah, it's... I don't know. So many days slid past, and when I think about my diary for this year, which, you know, I was so busy fitting projects around each other, that sort of thing, which is a fortunate position to be in, but it was quite a headache to kind of go, when do we do that? When, you know, and it got it all to fit. It's like, there it is, a perfect jigsaw, and then someone takes a wrecking ball to it. Yeah. You know, the whole thing, everything crossed out. None of that is happening. That was like, that was some joke scheduling you did to practice scheduling, and no, cancelled.
Yeah.
But it's probably good for us as a sort of overmighty species, isn't it, to realise that all of our plans are provisional, and indeed that there's only one habitable planet we're aware of in the universe, and literally no one could get away from it. However, you know, there wasn't the place where the rich people can go where there's no COVID. You know,
no.
Prince Charles got it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there you are. You can't escape it.
We
have to somehow keep this blue ball going.
Yes.
As Ronnie O'Sullivan might say.
I don't think he has the wit. He might do, though.
With that cue ball control, he must do.
Actually, I saw somebody did a podcast with him recently, quite a sort of serious one about how do you cope with depression and those sort of things. I think he thinks quite deeply about those things, doesn't he? And
he's always been the troubled snooker player, hasn't he? I mean, you know, Alex Higgins was the troubled snooker player as well, but sort of dealt with it in a different way.
Yeah.
But very much, yes, I'm... kept saying, it seemed, when I was really into snooker, it seemed every year Ronnie O'Sullivan would threaten to retire. And you could see the whole of the snooker world panic because he was such a big star. And, you know, and then he wouldn't retire, obviously, because what he has done with his life is play snooker. And he must, on some level, be really into it.
Yes.
So he would inevitably go back into it and they would be relieved. And,
there's quite a lot of money involved in it,
There is, yes. But
I did see recently that one of the snooker players in the World Championships was asked by one of the reporters, have you heard what Ronnie said? And he said, I haven't, no. But did he say he's not playing very well, his action's gone, and he's almost certainly going to lose? And he said, yeah, he did say that. He says, yeah, he says that before every final.
I mean, he's absolutely the SWAT who says he hasn't revised before the exam. Oh, I haven't done anything.
You can find the technical
I haven't had time for snooker. I've been, you know, reading a lot of philosophy. Then someone told me the book was upside down.
Yep. That's Ronnie for you.
I think he really obviously is, you know, in some way wants to think about things. He wants to philosophise beyond snooker. The world can't just be snooker. But at the same time, the majestic simplicity of the green bays still draws him in. And, you know, the thing is, he's good enough at potting that people will listen for a surprisingly long time to what he's thinking.
Almost as good at potting as I am with my tomatoes.
Yeah.
And there you are, full circle. Yeah. David Mitchell, thank you very much for talking to me.
Absolutely.
It's been lovely.
The blue ball, the red ball, the planet Earth, the tomato.
It's all there. Yeah. All life is there. Right, OK, so we should talk about the things that you want to put into a time capsule.
Yes. The first thing, should I say the first thing I would like to put in is, this would be a technological challenge, but I've noticed other people are putting whole concepts into this capsule, so it's, you know...
Whole continents?
Yeah. But in a way, it should be theoretically easier to put a continent in than a concept.
Yes.
You know, because at least that we're dealing with physical objects.
Mm-hmm.
Asia should be able to go in to just a very large capsule.
Yes.
But could you put hope in? I'd like to put, however, more simply... a Joe's ice cream in. And a Joe's ice cream is an ice cream parlour in Swansea.
Mm.
And this would obviously involve a refrigeration / freezing unit.
Yes.
And long-term battery or electric
power. Yeah, you don't want just a creamy puddle.
Exactly. No. Otherwise, yeah. We'd make the cone soggy. And I would have a cone with standard Joe's ice cream, which is their ice cream. I think it's nominally vanilla. They also these days do a whole range of different flavours like everyone does. But what they have historically produced is an ice cream. And they have that and they do it with chocolate bits on. I think they're called chocolate vermicelli. Like hundreds and thousands, but all chocolate coloured.
Mm.
With that on, and that would go in there as the nicest ice cream in the world. I've got a few branches now And the original one is in a sort of centre of Swansea, but the one I most went to as a child was when they opened up in the Mumbles. Because my grandparents lived in Swansea, my mum was born there, and we used to go there, go to the Gower. So it's that's the sort of core memory of my childhood.
Yeah.
And I went back there when I was doing a show at the theatre there with Lee Mack and Rob Brydon, and I went and had a Joe's ice cream, and it's just the same.
Brilliant.
They haven't messed around with it. As I say, they have also got a cabinet, of, so you can have pistachio and all this.
You can ignore that.
That thing. But ignore that. Just get their ice cream. It comes from a hole in the counter. It's sort of a bit sloppy.
Mm.
And it's unlike any other ice cream. And I think it's the most delicious. Although I would accept there will be people who'd think, I like ice cream and this is different from ice cream and I don't like it. So
it's not like a traditional Walls ice cream.
So it's not. They, yeah. But I do,
homemade, is it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're professionals. So, you know, it is made in some sort of professional ice cream facility. But
or their home.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like you used to think of it as your garden. Now, of course, it's a professional tomato-growing zone.
Indeed.
So maybe it started more homey, but, you know, next to the whatever else was on the stove. Do you put ice cream on the stove? I somehow doubt it. But anyway, now it's, I imagine, a factory, but another nice sort of factory.
Yeah. There is heat involved in the process of freezing, isn't there? Must be.
Yeah.
The heat comes out of the back of a fridge. I mean, yeah. You've got to take the heat out of it.
You've got, exactly. It's got to go somewhere, hasn't
David,
it?
We know yeah. nothing about this no, at all, do we?
I think what is clear is that there is a certain amount of coldness and hotness in the universe and nothing can change that. I think that's an insight Zeus had. But yes, it's absolutely true. Around fridges, it gets warm.
Yeah.
In them, it's cold. So overall, they've achieved nothing.
Why didn't they just leave it all where it was?
Just leave it where it was.
Stop
it's
messing
just all adding up to the same whatever it was.
But this is not Joe's fault, is it?
No. Joe, I mean, Joe, because this is an ice cream parlour that was, I think, set up by Italians who moved to Swansea in, like, the 1920s.
That's I think there were a lot, weren't there?
Yeah. And it was... But no, what it was, which is brilliant, was quite successful. If it was very successful, it would be in every freezer everywhere and it would be a pale shadow of whatever recipe originally came over from Italy.
Indeed.
But because it's only been successful enough to go from the 1920s to now, from one branch to maybe four, then it's still basically the same thing, but four times as many people could enjoy it. So I would heartily recommend it. But it's a sort of key flavour in the centre of my childhood because it was the happiest time for us as a family was going to Swansea and going to the beach. And I, you know, sort of identified very strongly with Swansea as a place. And then my grandparents died and my parents live in Oxford and we never go there and it's gone.
Mm.
It's sort of, and so I, it would be nice to be there in the time capsule to remind me of that part of my childhood and
yes
because I had a nice childhood, you know. I don't look back on it in a, you know, I got stressed about things as you might imagine. But I sort of think, no, fair play everyone, you gave me a nice childhood, I was loved and I felt like I mattered and I had nice experiences, but also I wasn't born in the lap of ridiculous luxury that then left me unprepared for a world where you have to pay a gas bill. So, you know.
Those places are gorgeous, aren't they? My children have a place in France. My wife's parents moved to France. Mm. And so I know, particularly my son, is desperate for me to buy a small place in France so that he can basically give his children the same experience that he had, which is turning up at this place in the middle of nowhere in the countryside in France and just messing about in rivers and walking across countryside and picking sunflowers and eating in the garden.
Mm.
That's what he'd like to do with them. And my wife said, I don't want a place in France. My parents had a place in France. I'm fed up with going to France. So we've never done it.
Get his own place in France.
I know.
We can't all be buying people places in France just for childhood experiences. And well, also, it doesn't work with the child. If there's that much paperwork and hassle, the sunflowers won't work when basically you see your grandparents beside themselves with the admin of what local taxes they're supposed to pay. And,
no.
You know, apparently we've never paid the water rates forever. I've got this incomprehensible letter and Credit Agricole say I'm a felon.
It would be a bit like those scenes towards the end of Groundhog Day, you know, when Bill Murray is desperate to be the most wonderful person to spend a day with.
Yes, I love kids. That's the moment.
That would be what he'd be desperately saying to his children. This is what the holiday in France is like. It's brilliant. Come on, look, sunflowers.
You see the sunflowers, the memory, the fish in the street. Have you fish in the street? I mean, now look, we're eating in the garden. This is the garden. This is a memory, right?
Hold a sunflower.
Yeah. Let's get a picture of it.
Yes.
Try and smile.
Yep. I think when you try to go back like that...
Well, you wouldn't... you wouldn't have chosen Swansea as the place for idyllic childhood memories, because Swansea is a, you know, is... It's not Venice.
No.
And it wasn't Venice even before the Luftwaffe had a massive go at it. And it wasn't Venice even before the town planners had a massive go at repairing it.
Yes.
It's not picturesque. Although the Gower Peninsula is picturesque, but it was where my grandparents lived, so it was a magical place of escape. And you, as a child, you don't see things in the aesthetically conventional way adults do.
No.
So I had so many things I loved as we drove into Swansea. There was a huge warehouse by the docks with sort of faded writing on it and loads of smashed windows. And for me, it just looked like the most amazing, spooky sort of castle. And then there was, driving along the front, along the Mumbles Road, there was a sort of metal bridge, which is sort of a curved metal bridge. And for me, it looked like a chip. And I associated chips with Swansea, because my grandfather used to make chips a lot. And for me, it was amazing. It was a bridge in the shape of a chip. But you also realize what it was quite an ugly iron bridge.
Yeah.
But for me, it was just different. There wasn't one near us. And, it, you know, so all the weird... not necessarily that attractive things that were there became things I loved because of the positive associations of my grandparents and fish and chips and ice cream and the seaside.
By the sea, always a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing that's in some mad way wired into all of us. I remember being on the south of France at some point. You drive along the Promenade des Anglais it's in Nice and it varies, and you pass these huge buildings. And they're all, the windows are, wherever possible, facing the sea, because everyone wants a sea view. And it's there's something crazy about it, because it's just what we just want to stare at. It's a bit like the Easter Island heads. So you sort of feel there's a mania for staring at this water.
Yeah.
That mean that we will pay huge amounts of money for a smaller flat that looks on that rather than the larger one that just looks on, you know. And
that's true. And in fact, the view the other way in Nice of the hills, beautiful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's the sea you want. I mean, and I absolutely feel that, but I don't know quite why.
No.
But you get to the sea and you just go, okay, I want to have a look at this. I want a room where I can look at it. I will be reading a book, but when I look up from the book, I want to be able to see it.
Yes.
Because it's sort of, I don't know, calming. It's just sort of indefinably nice.
Even when it's raging.
Yeah, well, that's another thing about you. Sort of, if you had a house by the sea, seeing it in different moods would be, you know, that it's kind of great to look at if there's a storm, if it's really sunny, or even if it's a sort of mundane, drizzly day. It's still kind of fascinating.
Mm.
It's not logical.
No, no. I have a friend who bought a house in St. Leonard's overlooking the sea, and it was a wonderful 1930s design, built on the design of a ship, so it was steel centre this thing and then concrete all round it to make it, you know. And of course the steel in the sea air started to fall to pieces.
Right.
It was a very bad design. So he bought this flat for remarkably cheap. My word, this flat was cheap, Mike. It was great. About a year later, they all had to pay another £100,000
to replace the rusted steel core.
I don't know why I'm laughing. He's a friend of mine. It's cruel, really.
Yeah. But we all despise, don't we, those attempts at sort of architectural innovation. Yes. Don't try and do it differently, you idiot. even though, obviously, then when those innovations work, we love them. But the first person doing a flying buttress, you just go, why? Just do it. Do it like the old churches before them, you know.
Big bricks on top of big bricks, it's obvious.
Yeah, then they can't fall down, definitely. What's this, you know?
Thin ones?
Yeah.
Are you mad?
What's the point? I find that any kind of that sort of technological innovation very threatening. You know, I sort of kick against it and love to see it fail. And as far as I'm concerned, there is nothing hypocritical about nevertheless enjoying all of the innovations up to the point when I sort of achieve consciousness. You know, that's fine. They were right, all the innovators that got us as far as central heating and the dishwasher and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then now it's going too far.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't mind medical science improving. That's all right as well. That feels like it might impact positively on me.
Yes.
Whereas an update on an iPhone, I find, doesn't impact positively on me.
No.
I find that wastes some of my time. And yet I'm paying to waste it.
Yes.
Yeah. But that we get driven to upgrade them endlessly, even though you just want them to keep working in the way you were used to.
Yes.
The only thing that might make me want to go into space is that I don't want to go into space. In fact, I refuse to go into space.
Okay, I won't make you.
Yeah. But apparently they use quite old-fashioned computers in that sort of situation because they need to know that they're not going to suddenly crash for no reason. I mean, you know, computer crash.
Yeah.
But that could, in an astronaut scenario, lead to an actual physical crash. Mm. And so they use quite clunky computer technology, but they're clunky in a reassuring way. And
they know it's going to work.
Yeah, and I would like a mobile phone that's astronaut-proof. That's like, imagine I'm going into space and I'm going to be driving the rocket with this phone. I want that one. And if you say, well, you can't make calls, I'll accept that. But I don't want the sort of temperamental kind of fidgety stallion of a machine that can do amazing things on a good day and if you know how to work it, but it's just so, oh, no, it keeps crashing. But the great thing is it can, you know, theoretically, the lamppost will know you're there and it'll be just light enough for you.
Hang on a minute. That could be a good idea.
You know there's that thing they were said about Piccadilly Circus, the advertising there.
It can be aimed at people.
It's going to be aimed at people. It's going to know the people in the area. Oh, yeah, here comes a gambling addict or whatever. Quick, Paddy Power or whatever. Yeah. Here comes a guy that likes trifle. Quick, major trifle brand. I'm not aware of a trifle brand. Maybe it's not marketed in the same way as gambling. But, you know, that. But what that means, and this is what I hate, is it means that no two people are looking at the same thing. There's no objective reality anymore.
Oh, wow.
That to add it to the subjectivity of our own judgment is that actually what we're experiencing is different. And that's the internet all over, isn't it?
Everything's
curated for us, and I just sort of feel, no, I want to be able to show me the normal internet and let me look for things in it. And I like that search engine, great, but there is no normal internet. When I go online, it's just the internet for me. And
it's what you made it, right?
Yeah.
By what you looked at.
And so then you go out into the world saying, oh, apparently this terrible thing's going on. But the only reason I know about this terrible thing's going on is some algorithm has said, oh, yeah, that's going to particularly get his goat. And he's going to click, 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 click to find out more about this awful little wormhole of human activity, whatever it is. And I might have been oblivious or seen it in a wider context if some computer hadn't decided, no, that's exactly what he will be fearful of.
If you'd looked at it at the same time as everyone else and seen their reaction.
Yeah, well, yes, absolutely. Mm. But that's what they, I mean, that's the thing about the news media. You sort of realise, of course, the way you get traffic online with news is not by making it entertaining or interesting, but by making it worrying. And that's when we delve down deeper. Oh, hang on, what's this headline?
Yes.
And then you click, and then, you know, hopefully you then go, oh, that's not as bad as they made it seem.
Often.
But that's those not as bad as they made it seem moments, that's how they make their money.
Yes.
So that this is huge enterprise designed to unsettle us, not inform us. If they're good websites, they can't actually lie. But the way the information is given, it has to be in the most unsettling way, because otherwise it's the news. It's boring.
Yes.
I remember that as a child. Now we're going to watch the news. Oh, the news. Who cares? When was the last time we felt that? The news is ever present, ever terrifying. Let's just check, what are they closing down now? What's Brexit going to mean? We won't be able to get all, and that's because we drive it with our, I'd better check that. Oh, right, no, that's not on my postcode or whatever. And then immediately that's justified its continued existence.
Oh, no.
It's awful. I want to go back to the news. 9 o'clock and it's boring.
Yes, and it's just information about things you're not very interested in.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
first duty of government should be to stop the news impacting the people who vote for them.
Be boring.
Yeah.
That's the part they'll vote for.
It's the budget. You know.
And you don't want to walk through Piccadilly Circus and have somebody next to you go, oh, look, and laugh, and you're seeing a starving child.
Oh, is it? We see, I don't think yet that if two people are there at the same time, there can be different images.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
So in this, that scenario would only happen if the person you're with would see a starving child and laugh. Which, obviously, that, you know, there are such people. But what might come up is so-and-so's patent bum cream. But it turns out you've spent £2,000 on it in the last year.
In public, in the street.
Everyone's looking around thinking, who's the bum cream guy?
Hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Busty dominatrix? Where's he? Yeah. A man sheepishly moves away from the crowd.
I don't know if they've actually managed to do that at Piccadilly Circus, by the way. The last time I was there, it just still said Sanyo. And I'm not a big spender on Sanyo. I can't remember the last Sanyo thing I bought.
Well, the next time I go through it and it shows garden sheds, I know they've done it.
Yes.
Because that's what I look at most of the time. It's my main interest. I never buy them. Yeah. I just love garden sheds. Yeah. Right, well, rather obviously then, I'm going to take Joe's ice cream.
Yeah.
Do you want chocolate sprinkles on it?
I definitely want chocolate sprinkles.
Chocolate sprinkles and some form of refrigeration.
Yeah.
And that's going into the time capsule. So that's your first item.
Yeah, I'm worried now that the cone will inevitably get a bit damp because obviously it's not good for it to be refrigerated.
The ice cream separate from the cone until you need it.
Maybe the cone could be in some sort of drying facility, you know, to keep it crisp. And then the ice cream ball, and then they become assembled when the time capsule is open.
Mm. You may be overthinking this.
It's just an idea.
Okay. So what's next?
Next, I'd like to put, and this, I don't know, I thought of these the other day, and now I'm looking at where I'm going to seem awful. Yes, a Nazi flag. No. Let me explain the... No, I'd like to put in a footlight tie. And that's because when I was at university, I was in the Footlights Club, which you obviously are aware of, and it's a comedy club at Cambridge University, and it has a tie. There are basically no occasions on which the tie is worn now, but the tie is sort of a hangover from when it was a more old-fashioned sort of club in the, I don't know, any time from the late 19th century onwards, and when people sort of wore ties all the time. But I'm very proud to have a tie of this club that I was very proud to be part of. So I'm putting that in as a sort of the symbolic object of going to Cambridge, meeting Robert Webb, doing comedy in a sort of serious but fun way, and that becoming a plausible job path. So that's my it symbolizes that to me, even though it's sort of obviously slightly
So what did you study at thing? Cambridge
history.
So not really the great, well, I don't know, history, great source of comedy.
Now I think there's humor in it, but I did basically very, very little work, the minimum to get through, because there was so much theatre and comedy that you could just get involved in, and it was brilliant. And it's sort of, I have to, you know, when you start to, because I've been doing this job for a long time now, and you can take it for granted that, you know, you've got this job and you know, there it is.
Yeah.
You can sort of lose, what's that thing? Imposter syndrome, when people feel that they shouldn't be there. Mm. And they're sometimes wrong about that kind of thing. Well, I think imposter syndrome when you've got a job as nice as being a comedian is a sort of, important act of gratitude and duty. If you lose the imposter syndrome, then you start shouting at runners, you know. So I try and make myself remember how amazing and lucky that experience was. I'd heard that people at Cambridge had this club to do comedy, and people like, you know, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, and before that, John Cleese and Graham Garden had been in that club, and I heard that it was still going, and I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if you could go there and practice doing sketches, and then that might be your job. Mm. And it was just felt like that possibility. I sort of knew it was theoretically there, but it also felt like Narnia. And it happened for me. I went there, I did loads of comedy and plays, and now it's my job. And that's, you know, that's amazing. And I, however grim the world may seem, and in lots of ways, I have to remember how fortunate I am in that. And this tie is a sort of symbol of that.
Yes.
And it's also a physical object, not like Hope. Right. Or Doctor Who, that Mark Gatiss put in. How can you put that in? Doctor Who put in what? Intellectual property?
No.
Yeah.
All of them. For these poor fellows are all jammed
in. Old actors, some of them dead.
It's very cruel.
Yeah. But with this, what I'm saying is a tie.
Thank
you. You can put that in.
Yes, I can.
I keep it away from the refrigeration unit, I'd say.
There'll be a cupboard with a proper tie hanger.
Good.
For the one tie. One of those multi hangers, but it sits there on its own.
Well, as you said, this is a capsule large enough for a continent, so there should be room to keep a tie uncreased.
I would hope so. Yeah. Plenty of room. So, did you meet Robert straight off when you?
Yeah, pretty quickly. I met him in an audition for the Footlights pantomime. He was a year above me and was already sort of a Footlights committee member and sort of one of the people deciding things. And we were both in an audit, so he was basically already in the show, although not officially. Ooh. And I was just auditioning, and I remember him as looking very cool. Now, that was my perception, and my perception of cool is inaccurate. So maybe he didn't. But I remember that he wore a lot of... And I'm now going to describe him, and maybe people say, no, that's not cool. I remember he had quite long hair and earring and wore a lot of denim. And I thought, that... You know,
not that's, cool.
That's different.
Really cool,
from, yeah, that's really cool, right?
Really cool, yeah.
I'm pretty sure he looked cooler than me, anyway. But but I also thought he was very funny. I sort of thought he looked a bit like he'd be into music, and yet he was very funny. And I thought, oh, that's I'm discovering that not all funny people have bow ties and sort of James Callaghan glasses. You know,
they're not all like the two Ronnies.
Yes, that's it. That's exactly what I've described, isn't it? Ronnie Barker.
Ronnie Barker.
Yeah.
James. That's a funny man.
Yeah.
Got to be slightly overweight to be funny.
That's certainly a principle I've held with. So that was... met him then, and then we started doing shows together about a year later. And that, you know, was great because we sort of have different performing personas, and yet we find the same things funny. Mm. And we just really felt from the first time we went on stage together that we were greater than the sum of our parts, that there was a sort of third element. It clicked.
Mm.
We were very lucky it clicked, and we were very sensible to realise it. And I think we both kind of thought, all right, you know, if we're going to do this as a job, we're going to need a bit of good fortune, and we're going to need to spot it when we get it. And we did spot it. And things have always gone, for us in performance terms, that they just have gone a little bit better than they might. Mm. And I think there is a sort of performing chemistry that we stumbled across.
Yeah, so. And easier to approach it as a pair.
Well, absolutely, totally. And psychologically, you're sort of dealing with stressful situations. There's someone else to talk to.
Mm. But we did.
And you feel less
mad. Your very early pilots we did for ITV.
Yes, yeah.
And ITV were terribly keen on the pair of you. And yet their reason for not doing it seemed to me that you weren't famous. And you go, well, of course they're not
And that's always the thing with TV, isn't it? They're so conflicted. They'll put development money into people they haven't heard of, but then they won't actually put the real money in, and they sort of feel that that's a good compromise.
Hmm.
Yeah, but actually, you've just totally wasted the development money, because if you make a pilot and then nobody sees it, you know, you're better off not to make it. But that's why radio works so well, because they will take a punt on the radio. But it was actually a factual thing. It was actually Channel 4, not ITV.
Channel 4.
Yeah. I don't know if ITV would have me on even now. They don't make much comedy ITV now, do they?
So what would be your 6:30 game show on ITV?
That's good. You've got to give people... It's got to be big, and as I said, it's got to be a lot of money.
Yes. Jeopardy.
I know. So. Kill the Billionaire. It's one-on-one. A billionaire and a member of the public. They have to wrestle in a glittering arena. And maybe we need some dancing. Maybe we alternate the wrestling and dancing.
Yeah.
I don't know. And a point tally is kept. And one person obviously has to die. But if it's the billionaire, you keep their billions. And if it's the other person, ITV doubles the billionaire's billions. So is that workable?
I'm on the phone immediately.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's difficult casting the billionaires because what have they got to gain?
Well, twice as much.
Yeah, I suppose so. There's a type of person that would care about having £3 billion when they already had £3 billion.
Only a billionaire.
It's a billionaaire. Anyone else would go, do you know what, half a billion and I'm sorted. I've run out of ideas after about, you know...
20 million.
Yeah, exactly. Although you say that. you start thinking about 20 million and you would soon think, if only it was 50.
Then, you know, that's why billionaires would fight to the death exactly. for another 3 billion.
Yeah, because they're thinking, my seventh super yacht hasn't got a third helipad. I feel humiliated at Cannes.
Oh my God, what a dreadful world. So was Olivia part of that yes. footlights as well?
Yes, she was. She was in that same pantomime that Rob and I met on was wow. also where I met her. And she was brilliant. And I do remember being on stage with her and being on stage with Rob and thinking, oh, this is different from doing plays at school. This feels really like these people know what they're doing. Yes. And then I was in lots of other plays at university that I thought actually is quite like plays at school. But then, you know, not everything had, you know, a future Oscar winner and my future comedy partner in, no. you know. And
no, I did People Like Us. I think maybe one of the first television things that Olivia did. She was extraordinary.
Yeah.
No. It was so perfect. And so much better than the rest of us. And she'd never done anything. So,
yeah. No,
there we are.
Yeah, she's really brilliant. You hear a lot of people talk about meeting, that sometimes people's success is surprising. And you're going to go, oh, no, I met them. And, they, you know, with her, I absolutely... If you had asked me in the January of 1994 who that you've met will win an Oscar, I'd swear I would have said her.
Yeah.
Because... yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah.
Now it's I feel like I should say something negative about her.
Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah, that's think, yeah, brilliant, but selfish.
No, she, yeah, all so nice. I mean, not really nice. Really nice and kind and fun and funny and has an impish sense of humour despite being nice. Not one of those impish sense of humours like mine that reveal actual inner hate that I'm only allowing out to an impish extent in order to yes. remain part of society. No. No, just a nice little dig, but really she's, you know, heart of gold. Sickening.
Sickening, yes. Well, she's not going in then.
Yeah.
No, but we are going to put your footlights tie.
Yes, please.
And yeah. keep it beautifully ironed and neat.
Yeah, and yeah, try and get some of the gravy stains out.
What is the symbol on it?
There's no symbol, it's a stripe.
And it's proper old school then.
Yeah, particularly, and it's, I think... Can't actually, I could go and fetch it, but there's like a reddish one, a greyish one, and another one. It's not, you're aware it's not the first club tie commissioned, that, you know, some of the bigger colours went to earlier clubs, but its uniqueness relies on quite an unpleasing combination of colours.
Yes. Right, okay, so that's your tie inside the time capsule.
Yes.
So we move on to item number three.
OK, we're going to take a break here for some adverts. I have no idea what these adverts are going to be, or in fact, if there are going to be any adverts. But here's the break anyway.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed the adverts. Or the silence. Right, let's get back to David and find out what else he would like to put into his time capsule.
Well, item number three is sort of continuing a sort of loathsome theme in terms of the object. My item number three, actually, just because I like it as an object, but also for other related reasons, is my silver-topped cane. And one of the reasons I put it in the time capsule is that I have never used it. I bought it in an antique shop in Shrewsbury because I, as a child, thought I lost. Remember, I don't know where I saw it on the telly or someone with a silver-topped cane. And I became obsessed with it. I wanted a silver-topped cane. And you used to actually be able to get plastic ones at joke shop, which would sort of had the silver top would be white and then a black, but it was just a plastic thing, and you could put a cap on the bottom. I think the idea is it was like a magician's thing. You could put a cap on the bottom and bang it on the ground and it would go bang.
Yeah.
And so my parents bought me one of those. Unfortunately, what I wanted was the one I'd seen on TV, which was a real one. And they, for some reason, thought that was an inappropriate present for an eight-year-old. So I never got my real silver-top cane. And so when I saw one in a shop in Shrewsbury, it was the year after I'd got married. We were, as an anniversary trip, we went to North Wales and Shrewsbury and drove around, and it was lovely. And we went into an antique shop looking for things for the house, which we'd also just recently bought. And so I was thinking, I've got a house, I've got a wife, I've got stairs, you know. And I saw this silver-top cane and I thought, oh, I'd like to buy that. And it was about 25 quid, I think. It was probably only a silver plate. It's got and now I own it. I've got a silver-topped cane. In fact, another thing I wanted as a child was a top hat. People won't be surprised to learn that. But again, my parents got me a plastic one. You know, you can get the sort of...
I didn't think it was a good idea to go to school in one.
They sent me... I went to private schools, but not the sort where you wear top hats. The middle ranking, as it were. But what I wanted, of course, was, again, I'd seen it, and I could tell the difference from the plastic one. I wanted a silk top hat, like Jeremy Brett wore as Sherlock Holmes, that kind of thing.
Yes.
My wife bought me one of them for Christmas a few years ago. So I now have a top hat and a silver-topped cane. I don't have an opera cloak, but but there's literally, you know, no occasion, even pre-lockdown, no occasions where it's de rigueur to wear a top hat and carry a silver-top cane. But I'm very proud to own one, and it's a sort of, again, the sort of, for me, it represents having a grown-up life, living in a house with a wife I love, and now we've got a daughter, and that kind of, all those things that I never thought would happen to me. And I really never thought it right up until my mid-30s, you know, in the terms of, because I sort of felt like, you know, okay, I've got this job doing comedy, and I'm very lucky to do that, but I'm not a proper person. No, I don't. And I still feel that quite a lot. I don't have a driving license. I don't wet shave. Those are the two key things that I think mean I'm not really a man. But in some ways, I'm getting away with it. You know, I'm sitting in a house that, and I'm on the deeds. Probably not the deeds. They're probably an online thing. Yeah. You know, I'm paying a mortgage.
And you've got a wife who hasn't noticed. You're not a man.
Yeah, she doesn't. I think on some level she quite likes it. I think, you know, wet shaved and drove a car, I'd be a more formidable decision making threat in the house. So I'm very happy to go along with.
Just defer.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good policy.
If I wet shaved, I'd inevitably be in charge. And I've got a silver topped cane.
Marvellous.
Except I've just agreed to put that in a time capsule.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you can take it out again if you need to.
Right.
So you can have it back if the occasion. I would,
if the invitation with
I would say
dress code.
The reopening of Upstart Crow in the West End after 5 years of it sitting there dormant.
Yes, advertising itself.
When everybody says, oh, they're all a bit old for the parts, aren't they?
Yes, well, I'm only a few years off for when, you know, Shakespeare died.
Yeah. And what did he do with his life?
One of the, you know, we were in Upstart Crow on the, in the West End, and, you know, and it was going really well, and then it was closed, obviously, because of the lockdown. But, obviously, that did happen to Shakespeare. Quite often the theatres were closed because of plague. And then people were, some people said, oh, well, I think that's when he wrote King Lear or something. He went off in a plague gap and wrote King Lear.
Yeah, like you do.
Yeah. He was more productive in general than I am. And some would say more talented.
Well, some. Could he grow tomatoes? That's my question.
I'm certain he couldn't.
No.
That's, no.
No, I don't think they had tomatoes by then, did they?
But I don't know, but there was a long time when British people, or English people, I don't know, thought tomatoes were not edible. It's a thing I remember from The Unbelievable Truth. It came up at some point that
they're a fruit, aren't
that
they?
They are. See, that maddens me. I mean, they are not a fruit. But we didn't eat them in this country, and they ate them in Europe, and then we started to eat them. But really, people thought, a bit like people thought you can't go swimming after a heavy meal because you'll drown.
Yeah.
People thought, no, you can't eat those. I don't know why they were around at all. I don't know whether people were buying them just to remember not to eat them. And then at some point, people discovered it was all right to eat them. And at some point after that, someone just started saying that they were a fruit.
Yes.
Which, this is I was about to say bugbear, and I've said bugbear, and I can't think of a better word for it,
no.
Of mine, that we accept when scientists say that a tomato isn't a fruit, or a strawberry isn't a berry, or a peanut isn't a nut, and it is not their business. They need to stick to Latin. I completely accept that they can classify things scientifically till they're blue in the face, and that is their role, but they need to stay off language. Because it's clear that in every practical way, a tomato is a salad vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a fruit. And it's giving pedants a sort of free run that they shouldn't be given. Because a pedant wouldn't get very far with, in scientific classification, tomatoes are in the same category as plums, not the same category as lettuces. You go, all right, fine. Interesting that you've chosen to bore us, but there's no one-upmanship to that.
No.
But whereas what they actually have been given is, well, actually, I think you'll find that's a fruit. I don't want pedants to have that ammunition.
No.
I want them to go, no, it isn't.
No.
It's a salad vegetable, clearly, as has been decided by society, by language, by chefs. And then if you want to talk about their scientific classification, lovely. It's boring, but lovely.
Yes.
But you can't start saying that we're, you know, in some way wrong about salads.
So you want, well, do you want fewer pedants or less pedants?
No, you've picked an area of pedantry of mine there, yes.
Okay.
I would like fewer pedants.
Thank you.
Less pedantry.
That's perfect. Okay, yeah. Well, and thus ends the lesson for today.
Yes.
I look forward to seeing photographs of you in a silk top hat, a silver top cane.
And a tracksuit.
And a cloak. I want the cloak.
Yeah, I don't have the cloak. Great, yeah.
You've got to hire one just for the night, for that Upstart Crow reopens.
Yeah.
David Mitchell turns up in wheelchair.
Yes.
Little withered old man.
Yeah, he has no idea what's going on.
Everything's fed to him through an earpiece.
Including his food.
Oh, dear. Right, we've got two things left, David.
Right, next thing. And it's actually, we've referred to it a lot, actually, but I made this. In fact, I might change it quickly. I would change it quickly if I was that fleet of foot, but because we've been talking in this area. So I sort of feel we've covered the area a bit. I'm trying to produce this show at the same time as being in it.
That's
the
wrong. And edit it.
I was going to put in my Upstart Crow bald cap.
Ah.
Because having taken it from the TV to the stage, I'm very proud to wear it.
Yeah.
And also, when we was first approached about doing Upstart Crow, and I went for lunch with Ben Elton and Gareth Edwards, the producer, about, and this is, at this point it had been commissioned, a script had been commissioned, and they were going to do a read-through in front of important people. So I had a lunch to discuss whether I'd like to do it. And obviously this was hugely exciting to be approached by Ben Elton, who had said he had me in mind when he was writing it, which I hadn't realised. So he'd been thinking about me typing away. And in fact, the first thing he said to Gareth was, so what we're really looking for is a younger David Mitchell. Because I was a bit old to play. When the series was set in the early 1590s, when he was about 30 and I was over 40. But we all reasoned they had a hard life back then. They aged more quickly. So I probably, in my 40s, I would pass for Elizabethan early 30s. That was, you know. But the first thing Ben said, as I remember it, the first thing he said, he must have said hello. But the first thing he said is, it would be great if you'd shave your head to play the part. I think that would be really great if you'd shave it back to a sort of, you know, Shakespeare's receded hairline. And I said, no.
That quickly.
And because I thought, I'm, you know, my hairline has gone back a bit and in different places, or, you know, but it's sort of basically there's hair on my head. I'm not going to fuck with that. You know, let's just give it the chance. I have no confidence that it would reset to what's there back. Now. What I need is to just leave well alone, get it gently trimmed occasionally. There's no problem going bald, but I don't want to go bald. I don't want to make it happen.
No, I encourage you.
That's my... I'll take what nature gives me, but I'm not going to be profligate with the resources of hair that I have.
Yeah.
Because he was saying, yeah, you grow it down at the back and shave, you know. And so we go. So what you're saying is, for long periods of the year, I am, because it's not going to go back quickly, I'm going to look ridiculous. Do we not have the technology to just make me look like that for the time I'm on camera? And so they relented, and I was allowed to have a bald cap, which took ages to put on every time. But because I was also thinking, oh, maybe this is it. I won't get the part now because I won't shave my head. Maybe this is me showing showing sufficient commitment. Yeah, but no, it was fine.
Yes, I've had the bald cap.
Yeah,
I've worn it, and it does take ages to put on. The only thing I've ever kept from those sort of things is the mould of my face that was made for a fat suit. Made you fatter. Yeah, I've still got that. Yeah. It looks like a death mask. my wife for years has been saying, can you please get rid of that thing? That you at 30 looking dead.
But that's the thing with an object like that. As soon as you throw it away, that's it. You can always throw it away tomorrow.
Yeah.
You can't unthrow it away.
No. We had work done on the house, and I have a feeling it's been mislaid. Not by me.
Yeah.
Not by me.
Well, that's irreplaceable. You can't be 30 again.
And look dead.
Yeah.
I know. Gone.
Yeah. So I'm proud of the ball camp, because obviously I'm mainly proud to do that show and to work with Ben Elton and, you know.
And the cast. What a great cast.
Yeah, great.
I mean, Mark Heap is one of the funniest men alive, I think.
He is, yes.
Yeah. He's got an individual way of being funny that is completely unique to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had it. I don't know if you ever saw him perform with a fellow called Mark Arden when they were the two Marks.
I think I've heard of that. And he's incredibly sort of skilled physical performer.
Amazing,
as well as vocally, you know, hilarious. And,
yes.
No, and he has, you know, the cast members that were scripted to be in the stage show, I'm glad to say they all were willing to do the stage show. But Mark's character, Green, had died by the time the stage show was set, because, you know, it's set about 10, 15 years after the TV show. But he came and played a different character. He's the only person who that played at the sort of equivalent villainous threat, but a different historical character, and was, I mean, he was great in the TV show, but a whole new level of hilarious.
Yeah. So Ben Elton, what an extraordinary man he is. His writing is amazing, always has
absolutely
been.
Absolutely is, and I saw his, he did a stand-up tour last year for the first time in a long time. It was amazing. I don't think I've ever seen better stand-up. and to be doing that alongside, he was then writing the play. He'd just written the third series. He's published a novel last year. I mean, he's so incredibly productive, and there's all great and interesting and about something and full of jokes. To work with him and get to know him has just been terrific. And I've felt I have a lot of things to be grateful for in my career, and working with Robert Webb for years is, you know, and continues to be brilliant. But I never thought, oh, there's a whole extra thing now. This totally from left field, doing a different sort of sitcom, very like Blackadder, which I was obsessed with as a child. The closest to being in Blackadder I could be without a time machine, I felt, was to be in this studio sitcom set in Elizabethan period, written by Ben. It was, a huge and totally unexpected extra piece of good fortune that I just popped into Ben's head while he was thinking of writing a Shakespeare thing. And it's the only way I get cast is when people have imagined me doing it in advance, because I'm more like me than anyone else on earth. That's the kind of casting I can nail.
It has to be me.
Yeah. If they've only got me in mind, then I will get it. If otherwise, not so much. I can't. But I can remain like me, you know. Yeah. Even when they're really looking for a younger me.
You can get away with it.
Yeah, I can get away with it. So that's,
not fair to play a younger you and then ask you to bald up as well.
Exactly.
Not fair.
Yeah.
The only person that that's happened with, for me, through my career, has been Andy Hamilton, who rings me up and said, I had you in mind when I was writing it. And it always turns out to be a slightly peevish, easily annoyed, over-competitive idiot. Outnumbered, the man who couldn't bear to lose a tennis match, even though, you know... Trevor's World of Sport, a man who thought he was incredibly funny and talked too much and wasn't at all funny. Everybody else saw as an idiot.
So have you spent a lot of social time with Andy?
I have. I have a feeling that I need to look at myself.
How great, though, that as a comic performer, what a great advantage you've gained by boring Andy to tears all those years. You know, you wouldn't expect, you hit the jackpot.
Oh, brilliant. Well, OK, your bald cap.
Yeah.
From Upstart Crow.
Yeah.
That's the fourth item to go into the time capsule. So we've got one item left. Now, really, this is something that you need to reject from your life. As
well, what I'm looking at now, the listeners won't be aware. I'm technologically astute enough to realise that I can be heard but not seen. I'm looking at my mobile phone where I've put my list of things to put into the time capsule. And the thing I want to put in there and reject and bury and leave is my mobile phone.
So, the very thing you're using.
And my weird, conflicted, but fundamentally loathing relationship with it is summed up by the fact that I nevertheless have this list of things on it. But I can't put it in there, really. Because
I'm going to ask you to move it away from my recording. There's another annoying thing that they do, you see.
Yeah.
So they may well.
I sort of hope it did for a little moment.
Just that interference. You get that horrible noise.
Yes, if I did put it in there, I would just have to get another one. Because that seems to be where we are. But I hate the extent to which I look at it. I rely on it. I hate the fact that it brings the internet and bad news and social media not just into my life but into my pocket. and I think we'd be better off without them. And I think that's the thing. Of course, they're like magic. As a child, the idea that you could talk to people, see them even, and live video wherever you were, it was a Star Trek thing. I mean, obviously the main Star Trek thing was travelling to other planets, and we're a bit behind on that.
Yeah, and being able to transport yourself from one place to another.
Yeah, that would be useful as well. Yes. But it's just one of the Star Trek things.
Quite a good one.
There it is. And, to be able to access all this information, and I think it was in the podcast you did with Stephen Fry, you mentioned how Douglas Adams was a big fan of technology and how he, after he died, the smartphone was like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like that machine. And, that obviously it is miraculous and wonderful like that. But the thing that spoils it is everyone having one. If it was, you think, look at this great thing, I can, but everyone can.
Let's give it to one hitchhiker.
Yes, exactly. If it was just you that had a, were able to call people wherever, how convenient, how brilliant. I don't need to stay in to make phone calls, to check my email. I can go out everywhere. I can have more recreation and fun because of this power I uniquely have. Mm. When everyone's got one, it means you can never escape work. You can never escape phone calls. You have to use that superpower because everyone knows you've got it because they've got it too. And so we don't escape the office. We don't escape work. And we don't escape bad news. And the positives are sort of neutralised by everyone having it. Mm. People used to meet up and they'd make arrangements and they'd stick to it. Now it's convenient to change them at the last minute or to inform people that you're being late. But it's better overall if you can't inform people that you're going to be late 10 minutes in advance, and then people won't be late.
Yes.
And they, you know, and all houses have phones. If you really need to get in touch with them, you have to work out where they are, and you could ring that building. I used to, as a student, used to ring the pub and ask if so-and-so was there. Mm. And that worked quite well. And, you know, you could usually get in touch with someone quite quickly, maybe not definitely immediately.
No.
But you can't definitely get someone immediately now. They might have turned their phone off.
Yes.
And now it's maddening. I need to ring so-and-so. I've allowed no redundancy in the system. It is vital that I obtain a conversation with them in seconds. So I think we'd be better off without it.
Have you been...
So I want the concept in there, by the way. I want, you know, like everyone's.
So you want the mobile phone and the whole concept of the mobile phone.
Yeah, the smartphone.
Everything.
The, yeah. Buried.
Locked away.
Yeah.
Gone. Like, very good. No, yeah. Well, it's very good. But I want to know, have you been sensible enough to try and rein it back? Because I know so many people who rail against mobile phones and yet have push notifications set to on for everything. It's constantly going ping, bing, bong.
Yeah, I do not have push notifications set to on for everything. Mm. Although that feels like quite a small gesture. You know,
because you go and
I've turned off push notifications, so...
I'm not going to know about it until looking at my phone every 5 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Mm. But, you know, in general, I've deleted Twitter from my phone. Mm. That was quite a big move.
Big move, yeah.
And I don't go on Twitter much at all now. I sort of sincerely feel it's a bad place and that a lot of the problems, you know, in terms of people getting bullied, people having horrendous arguments, people's careers being destroyed because they've crossed a line. I sort of feel with all of those issues, people focus on the subject that is being discussed, whereas increasingly I think the problem comes from the place it's being discussed,
mm-hmm.
and from the existence of social media as a place that seems to dominate human interaction.
Yes.
And I think if the place wasn't there, a lot of these problems would be infinitely smaller. There'd be less hate and less disagreement, and the forum fuels it.
Yes, if you were in the pub and you mooted an idea that was quite radical or bizarre, just on the idea that people... Wouldn't it be interesting if... Do you think that might be true? Those sort of arguments.
Yes.
Which are always interesting, I think.
Yeah.
And then you discuss it, and at the end you say, almost certainly not. Move those ideas on Twitter, and you're in big trouble.
Yes, exactly. I mean, people become addicted to it, and they want to look at it, and they want a bit of interest out of it, and outrage is interesting.
Mm.
And people having apparently crossed a line and discussing whether or not they've crossed a line and taking a side in that is all very interesting in a short-term way. But the cumulative effect of it is extremely negative and makes a lot of people unhappy. And I think we're better off out of it. And I worry, a lot of it's discussed, people sort of say, oh, so-and-so, it's awful that Twitter isn't taking down these offensive remarks that someone said, or it's awful that they're allowing this, you know, and that kind of thing. And I don't disagree with those points, but ultimately what we need to do is not dignify those places with that significance.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a place and everyone seems to be screaming things that you think are awful, leave. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I think that the thing is, if you go to a pub and there's always a fight, start going to a different pub. And I wish we just could conclude that social media is a bit of a nasty thing, a bit of a silly thing, and we gave it a bit of a go. It could have been a lovely global conversation where we shared things. Didn't work out that way. okay, let's move on. So that's what I feel about it in general, and I feel about it even more strongly when it's in my pocket. Because actually on a computer, logging into all that kind of thing, it just doesn't impact you in the same way.
You can leave the room, yeah, as it were.
The computer stays in the corner. Mm. It's not, you know, but on your phone, it's particularly, as you say, if you've got the push notifications that they want to say, let me all keep you informed about it.
Well, they constantly are saying to you, you should turn these on, you know. You should turn push.
What, do you
push
want
on?
To turn push? Do you want to allow push notifications? No. It's just so you can hear things that are relevant to you and helpful to you.
Or do you just want to be uninformed?
Yeah. Wikipedia, which is, I like Wikipedia, and I have the Wikipedia app on my phone. It keeps wanting, when it throws up a random article about, say, you know, about Los Angeles or Venice or Nottingham or whatever, it says, oh, we can't tell you how far away you are from it. Do you want to allow so that we know where you are? You go, you don't need to know where you are. You just tell me where Nottingham is.
I know how far away I am.
Yeah, and then I can know how far that is. Just, you know how we have a system for saying where things are? I'd just rather just tell you where it is in relation to you. You know, like, you know, just tell me where you are and I'll say, no, tell me where it is. But you sort of go, why, Wikipedia? You're a nice organisation. Why do you want to know where I am? Why does that help you? And then so we analyse, oh, yeah, people in North London are finding out where Nottingham is. Interesting. Let's, you know, let's get... Oh, suddenly, holidays in Nottingham coming through the front door. What?
Well, no,
leave me alone.
You've told me about Nottingham in the first bloody place.
I thought you were informing me. Don't take information back.
Indeed. And it's almost impossible to control things like that. I, for many years, have been... well, somebody writes a Wikipedia page about me.
That's me. Yes,
that's
Well, you're completely... I put a lot of filth in there, you'll notice.
Totally misinformed. All of it. Apparently, I have other names that I've worked under. Never have. I was born in 1947, which would make me a very proud 73-year-old. Which I'm not.
No, you're much older than that.
I'm much older. Yeah, yeah. Well, I look older. Yeah. But, you know. and all sorts of things. Lists, all sorts of programmes I've not been in. Apparently I was in the Bill for many years. No, I wasn't. So it's completely wrong. And I kept trying to change it. First of all, they wouldn't let me change my date of birth because they said, well, all actors want to change their date of birth. You know, send us your birth certificate. The genuine article. They didn't want a photocopy. No, my birth certificate.
Right.
To America. And I said, no, I'm not going to. It's my page. It's about me. I want to change it.
Yeah.
Well, go on then, change it. So I changed it immediately. Whoever was running it would change it back. So I gave up. And now I play a lot of very sprightly 73-year-olds.
So they don't... I mean, that is infuriating and fascinating, isn't it? Mm. They should at least, surely, at least agree... That if you, because obviously all actors would, a lot of actors would want to change their date of birth, not necessarily accurately, but they could at least say, oh, okay, this date of birth is disputed, so we will remove it, so that we won't say your date of birth. We won't say if you, you know, but no, the person who is not you, who remains completely anonymous, has the upper hand because of at some point in the past having asserted the fraudulent date.
Exactly
it. And you sort of go, now that's not logical. That's...
They might at least just say, OK, he was either born on this date or the date that he says he was born. Bloody actors.
Well, exactly. And then people are free to decide. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm with you. I'm with you. Well, I am going to put your mobile phone deep in the ground with all of its social media.
Yeah.
Or you could just buy yourself a nice old Nokia.
Yes, I've considered that, just for someone being able to ring me up.
Mm-hmm.
I may yet get to that point. My Luddism is intensifying over the time.
Perfect. That's what we want to hear in the world. And leave us on that positive note.
Yeah.
David, thank you very much for talking to me. It's been lovely.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, David Mitchell. You can subscribe to this podcast on Acast, Spotify, or iTunes, or your own favourite podcast provider. And if you get the chance, we'd love it if you would rate us and leave a review. In fact, we'd really love it, actually, because it's one of the things that podcast providers take notice of when they're judging a podcast success.
It's easy. You just click on 5 stars and then you write something pleasant like, fucking hell, this is good. Something like that. Anyway, you can follow My Time Capsule on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Just search at MyTCPod or at Fenton Stevens. This podcast was produced by John Fenton Stevens and the music is by Pass the Peas Music. It was a cast-off production. Thank you for listening. Right. Anyone got Roman Abramovich and ITV's number? I've got a game show to sell.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.